Hi everyone.
Hi everybody. Welcome
it's been
to
a long break.
Yeah. It's the longest we've ever taken because we've never taken a break before.
And we didn't plan to take this one.
No.
And it wasn't really a break because we kept on working.
It was working the entire time of it. But I went to a wedding in Sydney. Sydney is, as I remembered it and as Ellen did too. She wasn't there, but I was walking around going like, this is why Ellen and I hate Sydney, because it sucks.
I was there in spirit because Jess was messaging me being like, this sucks about Sydney, this sucks about Sydney. Oh, the wedding was amazing. This sucks about Sydney.
Yeah.
And I was well,
even the people whose wedding I went to, shout out to the lovely newlyweds Lauren and Carl, who are having the most amazing time in Italy. I got photos sent from Milan this morning and they're having a stunning time.
Damn, what a flex.
But even there, even both of them were like, we don't really like Sydney. It worked out the best for like where their family is and proximity for the people that had to travel. So
see, nobody's there because they choose to be.
No. And she's like, we weren't one of those people that like needed to have like a opera house like photo for our wedding. And because we weren't anywhere near the opera house. But just like as confirmed, like it sucks. And I feel bad for the people that live there. Like everything's on a hill. It's so hard to like find anything. It was so stupid. Anyway, we're back and we're here for the second episode of our WA season. To start off, Ellen has something she would like to say. Ellen, take over.
Thanks. Oh my God, you make it sound so dramatic.
It's not.
We just want to let everybody know we're going to be removing an episode and we're going to address the reasons why in a couple of weeks, but there's no dramas. No. This is not a crime junkie situation. Don't worry about it. It's fine.
She'll be
but
back.
We also didn't want to be like, we didn't want to do a sneaky delete.
No. We'll reveal later. It's nothing too dramatic. It's fine. We don't have any Patreon shout outs this month. So if you would like to be a part
But we
of-
do have.
Oh.
We do have an individual shout out.
Yes. Ellen has a shout out.
I want to shout out to Zoe, who is a mutual friend of Josh, who I went to uni with. Zoe apparently messaged Josh and was like, oh my God, do you know this person? And that person was me. So it's the first time that anybody has acknowledged my existence on this podcast. Jess is the one that gets recognized all the time and I have never been. So I'm incredibly excited. Thank you, Zoe. This is more exciting for me than it is for you.
Hi, Zoe. Welcome to the family. We're so glad to have you. If you would like to join the Patreon, you're more than welcome to. We have different tiers of like the levels of donations that you can make. We have Patreon only content that you can listen to, which is really stunning. And you can also request cases for us to cover. We've just been doing like what we want so far. So if you have any suggestions?
We've done two requests.
But if you have anything that you would like us to cover, send us a message on Patreon. Also, if you'd like to just get in contact with us regarding anything, regarding a case, or if you just want to have a chat and like let us know how great we are, you can send us an email at murderintheLandOfOz@gmail.com. You can also contact us on Facebook at Murder in the Land of Oz. And we're also on Instagram at Murder in the Land of Oz. We've been getting a lot of love on Instagram, which is really sweet. People reaching out and like posting about stuff and people posting about merch, which is really cool. If you didn't know, we do have merch on TeePublic. The classic Mitlu sayings of what a bunch of noodles, botany solves crime, and I gotta get me one of those Jim Jones communist monkeys. The majority of the good ones are all Ellen Rose Sorensen.
I have no recollection
trademark.
Of saying any of them. It's like I black out every single time.
You're just that funny. Anyway.
I'm just so funny. I can't even remember all my jokes.
No, exactly. So it's my turn this week. And I decided to go with one of the worst ones. Rock and roll. So obviously we're in Western Australia. And this one was, I think someone did message us about this particular case as well.
Yes.
And then I didn't know about this case fully. I'd seen a movie that I'll have a chat about later in the episode, based around the idea of this crime that we're going to talk about tonight. But we're going to be talking about two really shitty people and one amazing woman who is a boss bitch who I would honestly give my right arm to meet because she is so incredible. We're going to talk about David and Catherine Burney. But first off, I want to talk about an incredible woman. I am so sorry. There is a sound coming from my computer that is coming through my earphones, and it sounds like a dog chewing alfoil, and it is so distracting, but I'm going to work through it and it's going to be fine because I'm talking about the badass bitch.
But also only Jess can hear it.
Only I can hear it, so therefore it doesn't exist. But anyway, I'm going to talk about the badass bitch, Kate Moyer. As quoted by Kate, it's pretty rare to survive serial killers. You don't really hear about it very often, and the people that do survive are generally incredible, very clever, and also insanely lucky. So, Kate Moyer.
So lucky.
She left school. She was 17 in 1986. She worked 60 hours a week to pay her way. She worked as a retail worker, Feel Those Feels doll, in a boutique, and she was also a model. Like, this woman is stunning. Okay, so she was 18. She was living at home. She was a self-diagnosed handful, which I think is, you know, I can relate.
A big mood.
A big mood. And on the 9th of November in 1986, Kate Moyer was abducted. So she had gone out with friends to the local pub, the Cottesloe Pub, and then they moved on to the Claremont Hotel. We're in Perth, by the way. I've said this, but I'm just clarifying again. She went out to see live with some friends to go and see some live music. Her friends offered to drive her home, and she said, "Nah, just drop me around the corner and I'll walk the rest of the way." She says herself, this is in, I can't even remember the name of the TV show that I got all of my, not all of my, but I got a lot of information from. I think it's Murder Uncovered. Let me just check my, yes, Murder Uncovered. So in the episode of Murder Uncovered that talks about Kate Moyer's story, she said herself that this particular evening she was very drunk. And she was standing on the side of the road, making her way home, and she saw a car coming. So she threw her hand up to, like, get a lift. And in the car was a husband and a wife. And back in 86, with a few of the police people that were talking on this episode of Murders Uncovered, you know, you would tell kids that if you ever got into trouble, look for a policeman. If not, look for a husband and a wife because they will look after you and they will take care of you. Mm-hmm. So Kate obviously felt safe getting into the car, and they said, "Where do you live?" She gave them her address. They said, "Get in, no worries." She gets into the car. They're driving along. It all seems fine. They get to Kate's house. They pull up outside. And then when Kate went to get out of the car, there actually wasn't a door handle to get out of the car. So then,
oh, no.
Yeah, not cute. So then they were like, "Oh, reach through the window." Or no, they said something about the window handle. They're like, "Pull on the window handle and then you'll be able to get out." No go. Then she is grabbed, pulled between the two front driver seats. The guy grabs a knife out of his boot and holds it to her throat. And before this had happened, she'd heard the woman say to the man, "I've got the munchies." They drove about 500-600 meters down the road. The woman got out of the car and got some cable ties out of the boot. Kate was told not to struggle because the ties would tighten. She was covered with a blanket, and then she was forced to lie down in the back seat. She asked them point blank, "Are you going to rape me or are you going to kill me?" And they responded, "We'll only rape you if you're good." She was dragged from the car into a house, and there was like huge like guard dogs, big German shepherds that were quite aggressive. Once she got into the house, the cable ties were cut. She was forced to strip down to her underwear and her singlet. All of her clothes were then put into plastic bags and were labeled with Kate's name, and she was forced to have a shower while the woman watched. And she remarked in Murders Uncovered how weird it was that how weird she thought it was that they made her shower before they raped her. So
yeah,
they started asking Kate questions. Are you on the pill? Do you have a boyfriend? What's your full address? What's your full name? Like all these like sorts of different information. Then they put on a movie. They put on Rambo of all fucking things. And Kate asked if she could change the movie. She did her best to befriend them, get their trust, get them on side because she's fucking smart. She smoked cigarettes with them.
Seem like she's cooperating.
Exactly. Was offered a bong by the guy. And she tried to get the guy as stoned as possible because she was really scared that she was going to get attacked. So they had like a newspaper out and there was a picture of a woman that had been recently that had been reported missing the day before, and there was a big hullabaloo in the press about it and police were really worried about her. And they made a remark about the woman and were laughing about her. And these two people that had abducted Kate called themselves Margaret and John. So she knew, she gathered in her head, Kate was like, there's a high chance that I'm not going to survive this. So in order for police to figure out that she was one of the girls when these people eventually got caught, was that she planted evidence throughout the house so that it would lead police to figuring out that she was one of the victims. So she hid a lipstick under a beanbag. She stashed cigarettes in the ceiling when Margaret and John, I say that with quotations, were out of the room. She stood on the back of a sofa and like reached up. I don't think Zane has one here, but it's like these compartments that get you into a manhole. Yeah. Yes, thank you.
The manhole things, yeah.
So she stashed some cigarettes in there. Basically, that's she just smart. Wanted to
that's
tell
smart shit.
She just wanted to tell like the people that cared about her, especially her parents, that she hadn't run away from home and that she was, you know, dead. So John made Kate dance for him to Romeo and Juliet by the Dire Straits, and tell you now, never listening to that fucking song ever again. She cried as she danced, and then she was dragged into a bedroom with a single bed, and John began raping her. Margaret was sitting this entire time that Kate was getting attacked and was taking notes in order to improve her sex life with John. John
taking
told
notes?
Yeah.
I beg your pardon?
I beg your fucking pardon. So John told Kate that she was very beautiful and sexy, and then Kate says in this interview, she was like, I responded with like, rape isn't sexy. And she talks about this attack that like he must have felt like he was making love to her, because she was like, he was kissing me and like petting me and all this sort of shit, which is so fucked up. So after after this first attack was over, Kate was told to have a shower, and once again Margaret watched. When Kate went back into the bedroom, there was four chains. So one for her right arm, one for her left arm, one for her left leg, one for her right. 10 minutes went by of her being restrained, and she started to cry because obviously, and she really was getting distressed. She requested for a pen and paper to come in so she could write notes to her loved ones. She wrote in total five notes, and then she also began to scream for help. And like, this is a residential street. Like, there are houses everywhere.
So this is a neighborhood in Perth.
Yeah. So it also goes to show like what these two people will like must have gotten up to, that like the neighbors weren't interfering.
Yeah, they didn't even react. Yeah.
So then John comes into the room and he says, okay, sleeping plans have changed. So then she's brought in to sleep with him in the master bedroom. But Margaret wasn't anywhere to be seen. John rapes her again. And, yeah, once again, making love, like that feeling of like being made love to, because he wasn't violent. He was kissing, petting, everything, and he must have felt like he was making love to me. He got out a pair of handcuffs and cuffed Kate's ankle to his and gave her sleeping tablets so that she would sleep and stop crying. She hid them. She put them in her mouth. She hid them underneath her tongue. And then when he wasn't looking, she stashed them underneath the mattress. Once again, another.
Oh, God, this woman is so brave.
Right. Oh, my God. Okay. Because she thought if she went to sleep, there was no way she was going to wake up. So she, like, stayed up.
She was never
going to
wake up.
All night. So Kate in the morning was forced to ring her parents and tell them that she had gotten drunk and that she was staying at her friend Sasha's house. And Kate thought she was like leaving her parents a clue because her parents didn't know that she drank. So she thought, if I tell my parents that I've been drinking and that I'm at Sasha's house, they're going to ring Sasha's house and be like, after she'd hung up, being like, Kate, I can't believe you're doing this. Like, you're in trouble, blah, blah, blah. Her parents didn't do that, unfortunately. They went back to sleep because they were probably like, sure, sounds like you're safe, no worries.
Fairly normal, yeah.
Mm. So then John leaves for work. So Kate starts to evaluate her odds of actually getting out of this alive, and she starts to think, okay, with one of them gone, it's just her and me. I'd say there's about a 50-50 chance of me being able to get out of this. So when John left, Margaret and Kate alone, Margaret once again starts laughing about this report about this missing woman in the paper. And she said to Kate, you'd think a big girl like that would be able to look after herself. And when Kate looked down at the photo, it was literally just a photo of a woman's face. And she was like, there is no way that no one would be able, like, there is no way someone would think that that girl was a big girl unless they knew her. So then she realized that this missing girl was also caught by these people, and she was like, okay, shit. And she like evaluated from like all of their actions that they definitely had done this before, and if they don't get caught, they're going to do it again. So Kate was like, okay, I have to win this woman's trust. I have to get on her good side. So they watched Rocky together and they start chatting. She was even allowed outside with Margaret. They sat outside, and then they went back in, and there was a knock at the front door. So Kate was pushed into the bedroom where she had been stashed, but in like the flurry of the moment, and also because Margaret's guard was down, she didn't chain Kate back up. Kate's just in this bedroom going like, okay, what the fuck am I going to do? So she describes going from scared to terrified, just deciding in that moment that she had to do something to escape. So she was she stood up, and there was like these high bedroom windows, and she was pushing on this locked bedroom window in order to like push, like to get out. So she's pushing and pushing and pushing as hard as she can, and she finally breaks the lock. She jumps out of the window. She lands on her head on the concrete. She gets up. Obviously, she's fucked up from that as well. She gets up. She runs across the street where there are all these houses. She's knocking on every door. No one answers. She runs down the road and she sees like a vacuum cleaner, like repair shop and like shop. And she sees a guy standing outside wearing a suit. And she's like, let me the fuck in. I have been raped and I need to, and you need to call the police. And she was like, if this crazy woman comes up and says that she's my mother and that we've had a fight, it's not true. I've been held captive. You need to call the police.
Oh my God.
So like, okay, number one, hiding the sleeping tablets. Genius. Planting all of that evidence. Fucking genius. So strong to be able to force out, like force over that that bedroom window, literally landing on her head, getting up and running. She's literally jumped across fences being chased by dogs, and she's like, fuck this. Fuck this. I'm getting out of this. There is no way I am not surviving this.
Oh my God, what an amazing woman.
She's a fucking stunner. She's a fucking stunner. Anyway, okay. So the police arrive at the vacuum store. And they take her to Palmyra Police Station, where they're going to take her statement. And the only woman that was on duty at Palmyra was 22-year-old Laura Hancock. And this fucking bitch, she is a legend.
Oh my God, yes.
Oh my God. Okay. So 22, let's grasp this. Okay, Kate Moyer is 18. Laura Hancock, 22. Not a lot of difference in age, right?
No.
Okay. This would be Laura Hancock's first ever statement that she took.
Oh my God.
Because her superiors thought that Kate's story was just ludicrous and they didn't believe her, so they wanted to stitch her up for a false report.
Oh my, what? Seriously?
Yep.
That's fucked.
So, from what Kate said to Laura, Kate believed that there had been other victims, and that if she hadn't gotten away, that they would have killed her. And if they get away with this, they're going to do it again. Laura describes Kate's statement as factual, and she gave a clear account of what had happened. She wasn't like breaking down, being like, this is what happened to me, blah, blah, blah. She was like, she was to the point and to the hour of what happened. So, yeah, Laura had been instructed to stitch up a false report. So Kate told her about the whole ordeal being taken off the side of the road and the knife being pulled on her and the Rambo tape being in the VHS player, about the sleeping tablets underneath the mattress. Several times Laura leaves the interview, and Kate talks about how she thought every time Laura was leaving the interview that she was going away to cry. But what actually Laura was doing was going to her superiors and begging them to believe Kate.
Take it seriously. Oh, God, that is disgraceful.
And the only reason that they finally started to believe her was because of Laura's persistence, and also because Kate had told Laura that she had been given the sleeping tablets. And when she looked on the bottle, because like these people had told Kate that their names were Margaret and John, but she looked on the bottle and there was the name David Burney.
Ooh.
All right. So David Burney. And then police also gathered with the woman being involved would be Catherine Burney. Uh-huh. So David and Catherine were bonded in childhood, and they were both born into dysfunction, to put it lightly. David especially. Like, David came from a really unkempt family. They were subjects of a lot of rumors about promiscuity, drunkenness, and even incest. David's mother was known for her profanity and her coarse manner. And one of the other interviews that I watched, this lady who grew up in the same area as David Burney, like, described this, like, heinous woman that would sit on the bus and would just hurl abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So David met Catherine, and Catherine had also had – her name was Catherine Harrison. So she was 2 years old when her mother had died, giving birth to her younger brother.
And her dad
couldn't cope, so she was sent away to live with her grandparents. So Catherine was 12 when she met David, after moving back in with her dad, and her dad was very disapproving of the relationship between Catherine and David. From 1969 to 1970, that is 1 year, they committed over 70 different crimes, from safe breaking to possession of explosives to jailbreak. And when they were finally caught, Catherine was like, "I know I shouldn't have gone with David, but there is nothing I wouldn't do for him." So they were referred to, like, in this very dramatic Channel 7 TV show, as like Australia's Bonnie and Clyde, which I feel like is a bit much, but anyway. So when they were both released from jail in their late teens, they both ended up splitting up and finding different partners. So David Burney met this lady named Carrie in 1974. The night after they met, they went out to the movies, and David asked Carrie to marry him, and she said yes. And then a month later, they were married. Within a year, they had a daughter named Tanya. David had like a ferocious sexual appetite, let me just say. So he strayed from the marriage a lot, even going as far as advertising for sex in the local paper in, quote, "bored husband looking for fun times." He moved a 16-year-old babysitter into their house, and Carrie was like, "You know what, fuck this," and left him after 10 years.
Go, Carrie.
So Catherine Harrison found work as a housekeeper after she'd gotten out of prison, and she married the son of one of her bosses, John McLaughlin. They had 6 children together. The elder, and unfortunately, very tragic, their eldest son actually was run over right in front of Catherine's eyes. Sure, that was horrific. In 1985, Catherine decided to leave her husband because she had rekindled her romance with David Burney.
Oh, no.
So David was very interested in threesomes. He had presented the idea to his first wife, Carrie, and Carrie was like, I don't think so. But Catherine Burney was like, "Yep, no worries. Let's whatever you want, David. That's fine." So with no luck of actually finding someone that wanted to join their little band of dysfunction and grossness, surprisingly, they were like, "Nah, we're entitled to this threesome. We're going to get what we want, so we're just going to grab randoms off the street. Sounds like a great time." So they began hunting for women, primarily
the
hitchhikers.
The logic in that is just not present.
Right?
Like the decision-making, the thought process, it's just not
It's not there. They're idiots. Anyway, as I said before, if you were a kid in the 80s, you were told, if you're ever in trouble, if there's ever anything going wrong, find a policeman or find a couple. So you can imagine with these young hitchhikers, if you see like a like a man and a woman couple, you're probably like, okay, this is probably one of the safer situations that I can get into. So I'll get into the car with these people.
Because you're like, well, at least the woman's not going to do anything.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. So Kate's made her statement. There's two police officers called Paul Ferguson and Vince Kaddish who were running a task force on the disappearance of 21-year-old Denise Brown, who'd gone missing 2 days before Kate, 2 days before Kate had gone into the police station. And it took several hours for them to get the statement that Kate had made, because obviously with the police not believing her and wasting valuable time, and they got the name that Kate had given to the police, which was Dee Burney. They got the details of David and Catherine. They got a warrant and went to the street where Kate had been found. So that's Morehouse Street in Willoughby in Perth. They go to the house. No one's home. There's big fuck off dogs. So they lay in wait and they wait outside. And then the woman comes home that they learn is Catherine Burney. They told her immediately about the warrant and they go into the house. Catherine Burney is like fucked off her face on some drugs. They can tell she's just high. They get into the house. They look, there's a fireplace, which is not great. And there was some smoldering paper in the fireplace. So obviously they had been destroying evidence because there was a period of time between Kate escaping and then the police showing up.
Getting there.
So Kate actually waited outside in the police car while Laura Hancock inspected the property, and she remembered what Kate said about the Rambo tape being in the VHS player and the tablets under the mattress. Tick, tick, tick. Everything was there as Kate had said. Police then show up at David Burney's work. He worked at a secondhand like car parts shop. And the lady who was like the receptionist, like her dad owned the business. She talked about like earlier that morning, David had said, the dogs have gotten out. I've just got to go home. He was pretty casual and then came back like literally within half an hour. And then, yeah, the police then showing up the same day and taking David away. She was like,
oh, maybe the dogs weren't out.
But she was like, when the police was even taking him away, still acting really casual and like just arrogant because he thought that they'd gotten away with it because obviously they had been destroying evidence. Obviously with Kate's testimony, like, yes, there is a lot of like there was like proof in her statement of her actually being in Morehouse Street, but then it could easily have been argued that it was consensual sex and that she was there and there was just like a misunderstanding. So it was literally circumstantial evidence as to what Kate had said had happened to her. So the police were going to need a confession to get a conviction. So David and Catherine were both brought to Fremantle Police Station and they were split up. So Laura Hancock was now in charge of guarding Catherine Burney, and like the way she described sitting with that woman, and you know, after hearing Kate's story and everything that happened to her, like having to like sit in the same like room as this woman was just like awful. So Paul Ferguson and Vince Kaddish were in the interrogation room with David Burney, and they start like building a rapport with him, like hanging out as mates, like sharing cigarettes. And, you know, Kate, David was explaining that Kate Moyer like had been at the house and that it was for like a drug deal. Like she was buying some dope, like it was no worries. He did say that him and Kate had had sex, but it was consensual, obviously. So however though, Catherine Burney was in the other interrogation room and she said, no, never heard of someone called Kate. No one came to the house last night. So there was all this discrepancies in their stories because they're fucking idiots.
They're so stupid.
All right. So then hours are passing. No one's saying anything. Like David's like, they're trying to get a confession out of David, like about what had happened with Kate. No. Paul Ferguson then, like starts thinking about Denise Brown, and he's like, I've got a really good feeling that these guys are involved in the disappearance of Denise, but they're still not getting anywhere. So Vince then, you know, they'd made that deduction that they'd done this before and that there were other people out there that either had escaped just like Kate had, or worse, that there were young women that had been like raped and tortured and murdered and that their bodies were, out there. So he just so Vince Kaddish literally just says this throwaway statement. He was like, let's go and get some shovels and let's go dig up some shallow graves. And David Burney cracks and he said, Vince, there's four.
What?
What?
That bitch cracked like an egg.
Yeah. I mean, after hours, but like, I mean, cracked like an egg.
But like, cracked like an egg. Like, a really, really tough egg for 4 hours and then a real soft egg at the end there.
Yeah, just because he was like, literally, I was running out of things to say about Denise Brown, was running out of things to say with Kate Moyer. He's like, I just threw it out there and was just like, look, there's probably, he's like, let's just say this, and he, maybe me saying this is going to make him think that I know something that I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Clearly it did.
Mm. All right. Okay. So their first victim was Mary Nielsen. She was a university student studying psychology who worked part-time at a deli. Mary met David Burney at the spare car parts yard where he worked, and he offered to sell her cheap tires from his house and gave her his phone number. So on the 6th of October 1986, she went to the Burney's house on Moore Street. She was forced inside. She was stripped. She was chained to the bed. David Burney then drove Mary's car across town, dumping it outside the police headquarters. Idiot.
That's a bold move.
She was then she was raped, and then she was driven to Glen Eagle National Park near the Albany Highway. She was raped twice more by David Burney as Catherine Burney watched. She was strangled with a nylon cord and then stabbed and was buried in a shallow grave. A year later, after her murder, she was awarded her degree in psychology.
Oh.
2 weeks later, 15-year-old Susanna Candy was hitchhiking on the Stirling Highway. Susanna was a standout student at the Hollywood Senior High School. So she was hitchhiking on the Stirling Highway. So she was taken to Morehouse Street, where she was forced to ring and write her parents, telling them that she was staying with friends. She wrote four letters in total. She was raped multiple times before she was strangled by Catherine Burney. When Catherine Burney was asked about the murder of Susanna Candy, she said, "Because I wanted to see how strong I was within my inner self. I didn't feel a thing. It wasn't like I expected. I prepared to follow him to the end of the earth and do anything to see that his desires were satisfied. She was a female. Females hurt and destroy males."
What the fuck? What?
Sue was murdered at Morehouse Street, and then David and Catherine drove Sue's body to Glen Eagle Forest. After Sue had been killed because of the letters that she had written to her parents were still receiving letters from her.
Oh, fuck. Oh, that's so fucked up.
9 days after the murder of Sue Candy on the 1st of November 1986, Norlene Patterson was standing next to her car on the Canning Highway. She'd run out of petrol after finishing her work as a bar manager at Nedlands Golf Club. David and Catherine offered to drive her up to the service station. Catherine Burney then pulled out a knife on Norlene, and they drove back to Morehouse Street. Norlene was threatened at knife point to ring a friend to say that she was going away for a few days. Norlene was then chained and held against her will for 72 hours. She tried to befriend David Burney while she was repeatedly raped and drugged. Catherine became jealous of David's growing attachment to Norlene and said it was either Norlene or her threatening to kill herself. David forced an overdose of sleeping pills down Norlene's throat, and he strangled her while she slept. They took her body to Glen Eagle, where Kathy supposedly took great pleasure in throwing sand in Norlene's face.
Holy shit.
2 days after the murder of Norlene. So can we just acknowledge the escalation of these absolute psychos?
I was just about to say, like, hold on. Is this all happening in, like, a fortnight?
A month.
A month. What the heck? What the heck?
21-year-old Denise Brown was waiting for a bus stop. On the Stirling Highway after a night out with her girlfriends. David and Catherine picked Denise up and drove her at knife point back to Morehouse Street. She was forced to ring friends to tell them that she was staying with other mates. Denise's boyfriend and flatmate were immediately suspicious of the phone calls. On the 9th of November, Detective Ferguson was called to see Denise's mother, who knew that if her daughter was going to stay anywhere that hadn't been discussed earlier, Denise would have rung her. Mm-hmm. Detective Ferguson also started noticing a pattern emerging of other reported missing women making the same calls. The next afternoon after Denise was abducted, Catherine and David Burney drove Denise to Winneroo Pine Plantation, where she was raped while the couple waited for night to fall. They dragged Denise from the car, and David Burney raped Denise again and stabbed her in the neck. Convinced that he had killed Denise, they put her into the shallow grave, and then she sat up. And then David Burney grabbed an axe and struck her in the head twice, and then burying her. And the next day they chose Kate Moyer, ultimately their greatest mistake.
Oh, my God. Oh, that...
As Kate Moyer said, that confession was critical. I was in no state to go to court and defend myself. I was terrified of David Burney, and she was pure evil. After Kate had escaped under Catherine's nose, Catherine obviously had panicked and rung David at work. David left work for half an hour under the guise that the dogs had gotten out. In reality, he was instructing Catherine in disposing of the evidence. David's confession set Catherine off yelling, "Weak bastard," as she passed him in the corridor. Catherine was talking as if what she and David had done was logical, pick the girls up to satisfy David and her needs, and afterwards they just couldn't let them go. David said that that three of the girls were at Glen Eagle and the other one was at Nangara Forest. David Burney led police to the body of Denise Brown. They then drove to Glen Eagle, where the three other victims were buried. In sequence, David Burney led police to the bodies. They were neat, they were shallow, and unless you knew where you were going, you would never be able to find them. David led police to the graves of Mary Nielsen and Sue Candy, and Catherine Burney was the one who led police to Nolene Patterson, saying, "I'll show you where the bitch is buried."
Oh my and God,
Catherine Burney, because she is the most evil woman I have ever encountered, spat on the grave of Nolene.
In front of the police?
Mm-hmm.
What is happening in that bitch's head?
Yeah, I know. The exhumations occurred the next day with the pathologist. So at each of the scenes, a police officer was stationed with each of the girls' bodies, which I can't imagine what that must have been like for them.
Horrific.
At 5 a.m. the next morning, Kate Moyer was woken up by her father saying that police had found four bodies. Back at Fremantle Police Station, David Burney was taunting Laura Hancock, saying that, "You should have been the first girl I picked up. If I had gotten you, you would have killed me. You would have used the sword on the wall. The others wouldn't be dead, Laura. How do you feel about that?"
What the fuck?
When they were sent to trial, David Burney pled guilty to four counts of murder and one count each of abduction and rape. When he asked why he had pled guilty, he gestured towards the victims' families and said, "It's the least I could do."
Oh.
Kate Moyer maintains that she wished capital punishment was in state, saying, "I would have felt like I had received justice." Because of the escalation of the crimes, if Kate Moyer hadn't have escaped and alerted police, they would have kept going and killed more women at an alarming rate.
Mm-hmm.
On the 3rd of March 1987, David Burney was sentenced to four terms of life imprisonment. After being found sane enough to stand trial, Catherine Burney was also sentenced to four terms of life imprisonment by the Supreme Court of Western Australia. Under law at the time, both were required to serve 20 years before being eligible for parole. There's also talk about David and Catherine being responsible for the disappearances of Cheryl Renwick in May 1986 and Barbara Weston in June 1986, and a suspicion at the disappearance of Lisa Marie Watt, who disappeared in 1980. She was last seen getting into a yellow panel van. A call to the police after David Burney had been arrested was that David Burney actually did own a panel van and had worked in the area at the time of Lisa Marie's disappearance. David Burney's first wife, Carrie, accounted for his whereabouts during the abduction of Lisa Mott, him being with home with her all day, and she said there's no way he could have done that. She was like, definitely could be suspected for the other crimes, but he was home with me all day.
Interesting.
Then October 1985, Audrey Schofield, she was a real estate agent, living in the same area as David and Catherine Burney, and she would remember David Burney would wait for her to be alone in her office, and then he would come in and start talking to her and was making her feel really uncomfortable, and he was doing this day after day after day for a few weeks. So then Audrey asked her husband to sort of lay in wait for David. And as soon as David walked into the office and saw her husband, he immediately bolted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they started to move on to picking up hitchhikers, people who were alone and people who were vulnerable. A year seems to be a bit bizarre between 1985 to then the crime starting in 1986 with Audrey in 1985 and then for the first murder of Mary Nielsen. So police don't really feel like they were dormant in this time. So then they have been linked. It hasn't been proven of the disappearances of Cheryl Renwick, who was a young mother who in the months leading up to her disappearance was actually getting followed. She was actually getting followed by a car with a couple inside. Cheryl had actually moved houses because of the stalking incidences, mm-hmm. And because they were ringing her at home. And then one evening, Cheryl's daughter Michelle was home alone and a car had pulled up outside and Michelle actually had the front door open. And this woman literally just got out of the car. She was wearing a scarf and she was wearing sunglasses and walked straight into the house. She looked around, she looked at Michelle, and then she walked back out. And like that was like the hallmark of David and Catherine Burney, like taunting their victims.
That's fucked.
Yeah. And then the 25th of May... Cheryl Renwick went missing and her body has never been found. Her car was at the Perth Airport, and then what was weird was that the footwells of the car were actually covered in sand, and Cheryl's daughter Michelle was like, we never went to the beach, like mm-hmm. ever. So I don't mm-hmm. understand why there would be sand
in her car.
In the car. And then police were like, it might not be from the beach. It could be like from the sandy ground of like Glen Eagle.
Right.
And Michelle also talked about this story, like after the arrest of David and Catherine Burney, they were dredging up like lakes and all that stuff to like find mm-hmm. like items. And she described of like walking into the police station and there being like a table with like a mountain high like pile of clothes. And they actually found a top that belonged to her that her mother used to borrow. So once again, not been proven. Barbara Weston, who also disappeared, she was a 38-year-old mother of two. She was visiting a pub on the 27th of June, 1986. Cheryl Renwick, Barbara Weston, Mary Nielsen, and Denise Brown were all public knowledge. So with so many missing women in such a short amount of time, like the media were like quick to note that this mm-hmm. was the work of a serial killer.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1991, so... obviously, like David and Catherine were sentenced in 1987. So 1991, 4 years later, they police actually found the body of Barbara Weston, and her jewelry had been placed next to her body, which was also another hallmark of David Burney. Vince Kaddish, one of the arresting officers, got permission to take David Burney out of prison, actually to the burial site where they had found Barbara Weston. But David gave no response. I think he said like, so what am I supposed to say?
Right.
He was visited in prison and was asked if there were other victims out there. And there was a gentleman that had started having went in and was talking to David Burney and asked basically, were there other victims? And apparently David Burney nodded. In exchange for the names of the other victims, he requested a conjugal visit with Catherine, which was denied.
No shit, it was denied. Are you kidding? No shit,
right? And then on October 7th, 2005, at 4:30 a.m., David Burney was found dead in his cell at the Casuarina prison. He was 54. An inquest found that he had hanged himself from an air vent using a length of cord. Various factors led to his suicide. A failure to provide him with antidepressants had exacerbated his depression. His computer had been confiscated and he was suspected of sexually assaulting another prisoner. He was described by a former prison officer as a model prisoner. Yup.
As if.
Who apparently looked after injured animals. Catherine was not allowed to attend his funeral.
Good.
Catherine Burney was imprisoned in Bandy Up Women's Prison. Since being incarcerated, she has worked as a prison librarian and also appeared in a prison production of Nonsense. In 2007, her parole application was rejected, and then the Attorney General of Western Australia, Jim McGuinty, said that her release was unlikely while he remained in office. Her case was to be reviewed again in January 2010. However, on 14th of March 2009, a new Western Australian Attorney General, Christopher Porter, following requests from the victim's family, determined she would stay in jail for life. The decision makes her the third Australian woman after Catherine Knight and Patricia Briers to have her papers marked never to be released. Her appeal of this decision was turned down in March 2010 by Porter. However, her case may be up for review again in 2019. Her fourth bid for parole was declined in 2016. In 2016, the Burney's final victim, badass bitch Kate Moyer, began to campaign to end Western Australian laws that automatically put convicts up for parole every 3 years.
Mm.
Kate has stated Burney has never even applied for parole. David never applied for parole, yeah. In 2017, Catherine Burney's younger son, Peter, called for her execution. He has stated that his association with Burney has resulted in his being assaulted, and he supports Kate Moyer's campaign.
Amen. I'm with Kate.
Okay. I end this part of the episode saying that Kate Moyer is an incredible person, and watching her talk about this, she has obviously gone through years of therapy and years of dealing with what happened to her. And I think her integrity and her strength in all of this is remarkable. So the next thing I'm going to talk about, I'm sorry I've just like pelted through this episode, but I have never wanted to not talk about anything more than these two people. I'm so upset that I've picked it, but I picked it and I'm almost done.
Look, we make mistakes quite frequently.
We make mistakes. So there's this movie that came out in 2016 that a lot of people were talking about. It's called Hounds of Love. And it was written, directed by Paul Young, starring Emma Booth, Stephen Curry, and Ashley Cummings. So basically the story of it is this young girl called Vicky. She's a teenager. She was struggling with her parents' recent separation. She was spending the weekend at her mum's house. After an argument between her and her mum, Vicky snuck out to attend a party and is lured into a car of like a seemingly trustworthy couple called John and Evelyn White. John and Evelyn Vicky really realizes that she's being held captive, and she's forced into this like dark world of violence and domination. With no way of escape and her murder like imminent, she realizes that she has to like drive a wedge between John and Evelyn in order to survive. John has like quite a manipulative hold over Evelyn, and it's far beyond like Vicky's comprehension. And so from what I'm telling you, it obviously sounds similar to the story. I mean, the movie's set
similar,
in Perth.
Similar, but more like jazzified.
Yeah, exactly. After, because like I'd seen the movie years ago, not realizing that it was based. I didn't know the story of David and Catherine Burney or Kate Moyer. And then I did all this research and watched all the documentaries and interviews with Kate. And then I watched the movie and I was like, I don't because Catherine Burney was the one that was like, she was the manipulator in this whole scene. Like this, like she was the puppeteer that caused all of this to happen because she was trying to fill David's needs. So when I was watching the movie, I was kind of like, sure.
Because in the movie, they make it like she, like the Catherine Burney figure, like lets the girl go or something, right?
Yeah, at the end, yeah. Right. And that she kills the guy. Sorry. Right. Spoilers.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
But the thing is, like, Ben Young, like, talked about, like, the making of the film, and he said that he studied 9 different sets of couples that killed, including the Burnies. But the thing is, like, the movie's set in Perth.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you're going to think
it's just based on them.
It's just based on them, which it wasn't. But Kate Moyer was obviously not happy with the film and suggested that Young, like, Ben Young would use his own imagination, and she felt a bit taken advantage of and confused. And why were we giving these people oxygen, like, and putting them on film? And not that it was a very romantic film, but, you know, there's giving them air.
Yeah. Giving them attention that they probably didn't.
Sort of like what we're doing now, but I'm more interested in talking about badass bitch Kate Moyer than I am about talking about David and Catherine
Burney. But also thinking about talking and, you know, addressing the facts of the case as they happened versus like glamorizing it, even if you're not like justifying their behavior, but being like, ooh, isn't this interesting? But I'm actually just going to make the story even better and even more fucked up and even all messed up. Like, nah, it's fine as it is. Like, it's messed up enough. You don't need to gild the lily.
Yeah. So, yeah. Kate wasn't very happy, which I think is understandable. And I could imagine like the other, Denise Brown's family and Susan Candy's family and Nolene Patterson's family and Mary Nielsen's family also not being very stoked about this whole thing. So Ben Young, who screened the film at the Venice Days section of the Cannes Festival, said that the comparisons were inevitable, but the film wasn't being marketed as true crime. Due to the premise, it's inevitable some people would draw the same comparisons to David and Catherine Burney because it was set in Western Australia, but that he thought with how they handled the material and people outside of WA, you know, not knowing about David and Catherine Burney, like it wasn't about them. So Ben Young was supposedly drawn to write the film after reading a true crime book about women that kill, which I do think is interesting because, I mean, look, the majority of the killers that we know about are men. And what I've heard people say to me is maybe there is a lot more female serial killers. It's just that they don't get caught.
They're not suspected.
Yeah. So, yeah, Ben Young then says, like, references to the couple are nothing but speculation and that his film was more about examining the issues of codependence, control and domestic violence. So, like, yeah.
Like, cool, that's your explanation.
I don't know. Like, I feel like if you're going to do that, then don't set the film in Perth where two of the most infamous couple serial killers are based. And also the looks of Emma Booth and Stephen Curry in the film who play John and Evelyn, it's very similar to David and Catherine Burney. Yeah. Like, Emma Booth looks like her.
I think, you know, if you're going to copy something, you should try a little harder with your explanation. Like,
yeah. I just feel like set it in any other city then, at like a bare minimum.
At a bare minimum.
And then
he would have known. It's not like he can plead ignorance.
Oh, of course he would have. If he was from Perth, like there would be no way of not knowing this story.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and like, to be honest, it wasn't that long ago, like 86. No. Like, so yeah, I never, ever, ever want to think about David and Catherine Burney ever again because Kate Moy is right. They don't need the air. They don't need the space.
And they don't need to be glorified in any way.
No, definitely not. There is nothing to be glorified in this story except the bravery of Kate Moyer and Laura Hancock, actually.
And also,
And
also the four women that didn't survive. They were brave.
Exactly. They, like, Mary Nielsen, Susanna Candy, Denise Brown, Nolene Patterson. Like, simple, everyday women going about their lives, just doing something that everybody else was doing and got caught up in this.
Exactly. I
cannot fathom, because Kate Moyer actually knew Susanna Candy. She was a couple of years younger than her in high school. And Susanna's father was actually a very prominent ophthalmologist in Perth and was her father's eye doctor.
Oh, my God. That's a lot.
Yeah. But yeah, Kate Moyer, I've never heard anything like it. I think it's astonishing. I also think Laura Hancock, thank God, was there that day at Palmyra.
Look, women, like, got to stick together, man.
And it's just lovely. Like, they hadn't seen each other for 30 years and then they met up doing this interview.
Oh.
And it was just, so sweet.
That's fantastic.
Not sweet because they were talking about, but just like the affection that these two have for each other. Because, like, Laura, you know, 30 years later, was still, like, so grateful that Kate was safe and, you know, just – and they had this, like, reciprocal, like, just wanting each other to be, like, happy and safe and comfortable, which I thought was really sweet.
Yeah, absolutely. That's amazing.
So, yeah.
Well, that's awful and I'm worse for having heard this story. Thanks, Jess.
Yeah, yeah. I've been sitting with this shit for so long.
I know. Jess has texted me so many times being like, why did I choose this? Why did I do this? And I'm like, I don't know why we do this to ourselves. We're just really just digging that depression hole deeper and deeper every fortnight.
Because I'm trying to explain to people that have, like, listened to this and they're like, why do you do this if this makes you so upset? And it's because I want to tell the stories like Kate Moyer and I want to talk about Mary Nielsen and I want to talk about Susanna Candy and Denise Brown and Nolene Patterson, because I would rather know their names than I would rather know the two people that killed them.
Yeah, exactly.
It is,
I agree,
so
100%.
Important to tell these stories because I don't want this to happen to any more people. And it is fucked up that in the last 2 weeks, 7 women have been taken by violence in this country. It is a fucking epidemic and no one is doing anything about it. And I'm mad. I'm really, really mad. Because if men were dying at the rate that women are at the moment, fuck.
Yep.
But no, it's all fine. It's fine. Like, lockout laws, it'll be great. No. This is not good enough anymore.
it's not good enough and it's never been good enough. And the more we talk about it, the more people can't run from the truth, I think.
Exactly. And I also want to say, I've probably all of our true crime friends out there that are listening, if you haven't watched Unbelievable on Netflix, I would 100% recommend it, because stories like Kate Moyer's will make more sense because of the amount of people that go in and report either about, like, that go in and report rapes,
mm-hmm.
and how they're treated is disgusting.
It is.
Because just like Kate Moyer, who was going to be stitched up for a false report, like, this story of Unbelievable is a true story, and this woman who was raped and was literally, like, for the lack of a better word, tricked into thinking that she had made this all up.
Mm-hmm.
Could you imagine if Laura Hancock wasn't in there that day? Mm-hmm. What would have happened?
Her and look out for her, exactly. Exactly.
How many more women would have been raped, abducted, and murdered?
Yeah. I think the big message from this episode is believe women.
Believe women. I don't see what the point is of someone running to a vacuum cleaner store saying, I've been raped, I've been attacked, I need help.
Like, and someone being like, but maybe she's lying. It's
but
like,
maybe she's lying about it though.
Yeah.
What the fuck would that do? Anyway.
Anyway, believe women.
I'm mad. I'm mad about a lot of shit at the moment, but I'm really mad about this.
Mm. You'd eat that jelly snake with righteous anger, Jess.
Oh, I'm so angry.
I agree.
Anyway, yay, it's done. I never have to think about it ever again.
Yay. Another.
You're next. Do you have your next case?
I do have. Well, I don't know if my next case might be our Halloween episode.
Halloween.
Spooky, spooky skeletons.
It's the 6th of October. 2 weeks.
Maybe it will be Halloween. The 20th. Maybe it'll be normal.
Not too sure, but there will be a spooky Halloween episode.
There'll be a spook, and then there'll be a regular, just heart-wrenching, horrific crime to make your life a little bit worse.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome. Once again, if you would like to get in contact with us, please send us an email at murderintheLandOfOz@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram at murderintheLandOfOz. We're on Facebook. We like to hear from you guys. We like to know if you're enjoying the content. Please make sure you rate and review. If you're listening on Spotify, there's also Podchaser, which we've talked about. You can sign up on there. It's like social media for podcasts. You can review each episode individually. So if you really particularly like this episode, or you really like Ellen's coverage on Ivan Milat, or you really like my Carly Ryan episode, like, you can get on there and you can leave personalized reviews to each episode. So we would really appreciate that. Patreon, sign up, donate money, help us pay for resources. That would be great. Yeah. I miss you, Ellen.
I miss you too. It was
such also,
a
everybody,
break,
Ellen got my
phone almost every day.
Yeah. We have really long phone conversations now.
We have really long phone conversations. We have really, really long phone conversations. And sometimes we have 2 hour long phone conversations twice a day.
But that's okay. We're not dependent on each other. I don't know what you're talking about.
As soon as something happens to me, I'm like, I have to call Jess. as soon as I get overcharged for an avocado at Woolworths, I'm like, you know who needs to know about this? Jess. And you know when Jess she needs does. To know about it? Right fucking now.
Yeah.
We have problems.
Literally, if I'm having like a conversation with somebody on Instagram, I'm like, I need to tell Ellen about this like right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Nothing happens without the other knowing about it.
No. All right, well, I'm going to go home. I have a day off tomorrow. Do you have a day off tomorrow? Is it public holiday in Tasmania tomorrow?
I do have a day off tomorrow. No, it's not a public holiday in Tasmania tomorrow.
Oh. Well, we have a public holiday tomorrow.
What public holiday is it?
It's the Queen's birthday? Yeah.
Good for her.
This is excellent podcast content. All right, we'll leave you alone. Get on with the rest of your day. Hope you enjoyed the episode.
Hope your bus ride was good.
That's
fine
too.
Hope you enjoyed washing your dishes or taking out your laundry.
Alrighty, guys. See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Let's talk about X, baby.
Crappy relationships, the bane of our collective existence. But what do we learn from our mistakes?
I'm relationship columnist Liz Best.
And I'm funny guy Tom Harris.
Ghosts of Boyfriends Past will chat to guests about love gone wrong and take you on a journey through the funny, tragic, horrifying...
And sometimes just plain bonkers stories about that crazy little thing called love. It's like a group therapy session.
With two people completely unqualified to be leading it. New episodes drop fortnightly on Thursday, so join in to hear tales of heartbreak and woe and hopefully wind up a little wiser or drunker for it.
That's Not Canon Productions podcast.